Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
This was a top story last week, and actually a lot of you called in and emailed me directly because you were upset about it for understandable reasons. City Councilwoman Maria Pereira, who's been on this show several times and many of you feel is one of the most level-headed, straightforward voice of the people in Bridgeport. She was removed from her committee assignments after referring to a fellow member of the council as an ex-felon. I wanted Maria to come on the show because this was, again, a story that I had in the AP News. Hearst Media covered it, many other news outlets. And as I mentioned, Maria is a friend to the show. And I wanted to hear from her directly what exactly happened here and also allow you to hear what happened as well. Because as I mentioned, Maria, people heard about this and were really upset about it because they really love you. So good morning. Thank you for taking the time to come on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me.
So what happened?
Well, first of all, I never called Councilman Newton an ex-felon in a that term doesn't even exist. Once you're a felon for life, unless your convictions are vacated or you receive a pardon. So that's not even a term I would use. The big issue really is my crime is that I am the vocal opposition to the corrupt Democratic Party in Bridgeport and to Mayor Ganim. I am the only member of the city council who got into my seat solely through the efforts of my constituents. I've never sought the endorsement of the Democratic Party. I wasn't endorsed by the Working Families Party, the Republican Party, that horrible group, Bridgeport Gen Now. If you remember, they ran digital ads that had criminal convictions that were mine.
I'm the only person who
was strictly elected based on the will of the people. And so that allows me to be fiercely independent. Nobody can say, if you don't do this, we're not going to endorse you again. If you don't do this, we're going to take you out. Because the only people I ever have to serve and satisfy are my constituents. Now, first I was censured. You should know I was first censured. And by the way, none of this appeared on the agenda. And one of the fundamental principles when you accuse somebody is they have a right to a defense. So they wait to the very end of the meeting. And they come up with these things, and I'm not offered any time to research, to prepare, to retain an attorney. So they censured me first, saying that I had yelled out that Ernie Newton was a felon. That's completely untrue. That's never happened. And it's funny, the day they censured me was the day I filed a lawsuit against the city council in the city for the redistricting maps, where they're trying to gerrymander my district. By the way, that's being led by Councilman Newton. So they were very angry that I and the city clerk filed a lawsuit against the maps they approved, which, you know, you have to do every 10 years after the census. And by the way, you should also know I'm Jack Hennessy, State Rep Jack Hennessy's campaign manager, and the machine is behind Marcus Brown. And his treasurer is Joseph Kolovic on the school board. He was stripped of all his committees. I don't think that's a coincidence.
So that's kind of it in a nutshell. So let's do a pause for a quick second here. So what does that actually mean when you're stripped of your committee assignments? Is that just for a week, a month? Is that going forward? Like, what exactly does that mean? Because I think that was also confusing for our listeners when you find that out.
Well, the censure prohibits you until you apologize to your colleague publicly that you are not allowed to engage in debate with your colleagues. The only thing I can do is make motions and vote, okay? And then about a month later, again, not on the agenda, I was not allowed an opportunity. I didn't even know this was going to happen. Ernie demanded, Councilman Newton, demanded that, because I hadn't apologized, that I'd be stripped of my committee.
How long does that last?
The council president, who you know is 100% in Joe Ganim's back pocket and entrenched in the machine, has made it clear that unless I apologize to him, that I will not be put on committee. So now we're almost through the primary issues. Jack Hennessy has a recount on Tuesday. I am starting to prepare to go to court. I'm an elected official. In fact, I received more votes than every single city council person who was involved in the Democratic primary in 19, and I was a top vote getter in 2021. To tell an elected official that they can't speak on behalf of their constituents, for heaven's sake, even Marjorie Taylor Greene in Congress gets to debate, gets to speak on the House floor in Congress. So what we have to do is I have to take them to court because they don't care about the law. They don't care about our city charter. They don't care about our state constitution. And so that's the way you have to take these people on. You know, it's okay to complain about what's wrong in Bridgeport. That's okay, but you also have to do something about it. And that's kind of what I'm known for doing.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Maria Pereira this morning, city councilwoman in Bridgeport, and she was recently stripped of her committee assignments, essentially, because of an alleged, something that she allegedly said. But here's my question, Maria. So have you ever, in any of those meetings, have you ever referred to Mr. Newton as a felon, like out of context? Has that ever come
no.
up? No.
So if I can explain, the night this was happening, mm-hmm. I had signed up to speak during public comment, and it was about the redistricting map. And the council president started gaveling me and whatever, just because she didn't want me to expose what was being done, not because I violated a rule. Later on the meeting, Councilman Newton was repeatedly stating my name because he has these long pontificating speeches, kept saying my name over and over and over again, which is a violation of the rules. And I raised a point of order to the chair and said, point of order, the councilman is repeatedly stating my name, which is a violation of the rules. She said there was no such rule. And I said, there is such a rule. And I'm just going to say right here, I'm going to make it absolutely clear on the record. I do not want my name coming out of any convicted felon's mouth. Now, I never addressed my remarks to him.
Right.
But, you know, I guess if you're a felon, you know, maybe it hurts your feelings. But that is the legal term for somebody who's had felony conviction and has been incarcerated. I didn't create the term. And if I had said, I don't want my name coming out of a pedophile's mouth or a rapist's mouth or a terrorist's mouth, what is so terrible about that? It is my right to say what I feel is acceptable to me.
Is there anything that says you can't refer to somebody with that term? Like, is there anything that says
you can't? No, there's a rule that you cannot refer to your colleagues by name. You can't do it in the Connecticut legislature. You can't do it in Congress. If you ever watch some of the debate in the United States Congress, they'll say the gentle lady from Alabama, the gentleman from Arizona. You're never allowed to say other colleagues' names because often when you're doing that, it's a form of attack. It's a
interesting
form, it's negative.
Maria,
and
I
never do that.
A top local news story that caught a lot of your attention last week was City Councilwoman Maria Pereira being stripped of her assignments after an alleged comment made during one of the meetings recently this summer. And Maria already said exactly what the dialogue was. And how it was taken out of context in her own words. And I wanted to just continue talking about this a little bit more, Maria, if you don't mind, because I think this draws a bigger picture that's really concerning. Is there any, I've looked, so please direct me in the direction I should go if I'm not looking at the right place. Is there any video evidence from any of these meetings that happens? And there's a reason I'm asking this question.
So let me be clear. Normally, CTV, which is public access, would record our meetings, but for so long, we were doing them strictly through Zoom because mm-hmm. of COVID. So they came for a couple, and I haven't seen them in the last few. But we have a stenographer, and I have specifically asked for the recordings of these meetings. She has admitted that the acoustics are so terrible in there, and then we all have plexiglass surrounding each of our chairs, that she has no recordings of these allegations. I've asked the city attorney repeatedly in an email. I said, I want to know exactly what the language is that you're accusing me. And he will not respond. I've sent him 3 emails. None of this was presented. Normally, when you censure somebody, there would be a censure resolution outlining exactly what you're being censured for. None of this was done. None of this was provided. And it was all done to blindside me because as I said, it's like if you're accused of anything, you're supposed to have, I don't care if it's at your job, you're supposed to have an opportunity to prepare a defense. And I could have retained an attorney. I could have done all those things. It was specifically done at the end of the meeting with no notice to the public, with no notice to me. And this is how this corrupt administration and the corrupt Democratic Party in Bridgeport works. Simply
so,
that. I think for them,
yeah.
If I could just say, Melissa, I think my greatest crime for these people is I am everything that the vast majority of them are not. I'm honest, ethical, principled. I read every single thing, including every set of minutes, come prepared to every meeting. I can't tell you how many council people come to meetings. They don't have a sheet of paper. They don't even have the agenda. They don't have a laptop, a tablet. They're literally such rubber stamps that they don't read anything. They don't come prepared. They just vote yes on every single thing.
So here's the thing. So Maria is, as she mentioned, the only way that this kind of goes away is if she apologizes. She's not going to do that. She's taking legal action now. Here's my big issue with this, Maria, besides the fact that, you know, look, your own constituents, people who listen to this show, were outraged when they heard this story. So it does reflect who you are in the city of Bridgeport. The fact that people are saying, you know, this is one of the only ones that we can rely on. And now she can't even do what she's supposed to do to the extent that she usually can. My concern is, how do we know more of this isn't happening? You know, like, I know you keep using the word corrupt and things like that, but I think it's really, it's scary if you're a Bridgeport resident this morning, if you're hearing that something is either taken out of context or you're finding any avenue to get somebody in trouble and remove them from the process of things that can impact you on a daily basis. I think that's very concerning. Like, I'm wondering if this happens more often than we know, but you're one of the only people that's just not apologizing and letting it go.
Well, I don't have anything to apologize for, because the assertion is that I said directly to Ernest, you're an ex-felon. That's not even a term I use. And my whole point of order was that he was repeatedly using my name. So why would I then use his name? Why would I be making a whole protest of what he was doing by using my name and then in return use his? That doesn't make any sense. So these are fabricated, they're false, and I'm prepared to fight it. And by the way, I have not reached out to my constituents yet. A number have reached out to me. I am going to organize a community meeting, and we're going to deal with this because my constituents deserve representation. And they feel that they have great representation, as demonstrated by the fact that in both 2019 and 2021, I received more Democratic votes than any other Democrat council person in the primary, even though I have never sought the Democratic Party's endorsement, and I don't want it. Why would I want it? It's such a corrupt entity. And so I assure you my constituents are not going to stand for it. And so we're going to now get together, and we're going to strategize, which is what, you know, I like to do, and we're going to prepare what's going to be next. But I will tell you, my constituents will lay everything that happens to me at Joe Ganim's feet in 2023.
Well, Maria Pereira, we would love an update on how this continues to play out. And of course, as I mentioned, Maria's been on this show several times, and I will keep in touch with her off the air. And if anything continues on, would love to have you come back on.
Okay, thank you so much, Melissa. It was a pleasure being here.
Thank you. Maria Pereira, City Councilwoman in Bridgeport. And for people who are listening this morning, I have made a request to have the council president come on to get that side of the story, but I have not heard back from them. So at least we have Maria's side. And as I mentioned in our news last week, we had the AP News article, Hearst Media as well. But I have not been able to get contact with the City Council president to come on to share their thoughts on this. So we're efforting it, but Maria was the only one who agreed to come on. So that's where we're at right now with this situation. But of course, we'll continue to follow it for you on WICC.
What's happening in Washington and how it affects you? Melissa in the Morning welcomes Congressman Jim Himes to WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Good morning, Congressman Himes. Welcome back. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing fine. Thank you.
So Congressman Himes, the last time you and I were talking, we were talking about the potential, which has now been signed, the potential bill that was going to mean negotiating prices for medications and things like that. And I know I've learned a lot about it in reading and talking to especially health insurance brokers about it. But the part that I would love to talk about with this legislation that, you know, depending on who you talk to, supporters say, oh my gosh, this is life-changing when it comes to climate change. But people who are opposed to the bill, you know, say this is a complete waste of money. So I'd rather just understand what this legislation is going to do when it comes to climate change. You and I have talked a lot about the next generation, my kids, your kids, and our grandkids being able to live sustainably on this earth unless something changes. So could you break down for me what is in this new legislation that's going to be what many are saying life-changing for climate change?
Yeah, absolutely, Melissa. And just for clarity's sake, for your listeners, I'm actually in Washington today because the vote on that bill in the House of Representatives will be in about 3 hours. I think you're thinking of the PACT Act, which provided aid for veterans that had gotten injuries in burn pits. That was actually signed on Wednesday. I was fortunate enough to be in the White House for that signing and very, very excited because it's a great thing for our veterans, many of whom experienced some pretty ugly things coming out of those burn pits. But
That was signed into law. You're correct. So this one has not been signed yet. You're right. You're absolutely right. Yes, I am confusing
the
two.
House, theoretically, in about 2 hours, I'll be voting on that. But let's get to your question. The Inflation Reduction Act does really three big things. It's going to cut the prescription drug prices for our senior citizens through Medicare and cap their expenses. It's going to provide money for the IRS to finally start doing some audits of tax cheats. And my Republican friends are raising hell over that. But I will tell you that there are estimates as high as $1 trillion in uncollected taxes that people don't pay because they don't honestly fill out their tax returns. But to your question, let's talk about exactly what the bill does with respect to climate change. And let's just say right up front, climate change is a global problem. So this is not going to fix entirely a global problem, mm-hmm. but it is going to represent the largest investment this country has ever made in reducing greenhouse gases. And the scientists estimate that the things that we're about to talk about are going to, over a period of about 20 years, potentially reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the country by about 40%. And by any standard, that is meaningful. And I don't need to get into the droughts and the wildfires and the 120-degree temperatures and everything that is what we're talking about. But to get to the specifics of what you asked, this bill is going to provide for about $300 billion largely in tax rebates for people who invest in the build-out of electric car charging stations. It's going to actually make it easier for nuclear power plants. And this is one that people aren't talking a lot about, but which I do support, to make it easier for nuclear power plants to stay online. All over the country, nuclear power plants have been shutting down. Some people oppose those plants, but they don't give off carbon. That's a big thing that's in this bill, because, of course, every time you shut down a nuclear power plant and don't replace it, you're building, carbon-fired plants to replace those plants. So the bulk of the things that you ask about, Melissa, fall in the category of tax incentives and other breaks for people who are building out charging stations, who are buying electric vehicles, and not just Teslas, right? We're talking about the kind of electric vehicles that most people can afford, whether it's a Chevy Volt or what have you. Preserving the existing nuclear power plant fleet and doing a couple of other things that will allow us ultimately to transition to clean energy sources. And then finally, it also contains a provision because obviously gasoline prices remain, even though they're down pretty dramatically, they remain high. Mm-hmm. And this is where Joe Manchin comes in because he comes from a carbon state. It has a number of measures that will make it likely that private oil companies will do more exploration for oil, more development of oil and ultimately gasoline on their leased lands than they are doing today.
So I'm going to back up to a couple of things before I get back to the oil. Would I get like a tax incentive, for example, if I decided to put like solar panels on my roof? Is that an example of something like other than the electric vehicles? Will people get incentives if they have solar panels or like if farmers have wind, like wind farms, things like that, the wind panels?
Absolutely. In fact, not just solar panels. Solar panels, if it makes sense for you because your house is sort of located correctly, that can take your house off the grid, which is a good thing. But not just solar panels, because, you know, that's a big deal for a lot of people. It'll actually have tax breaks for people that do things like replace old leaky windows with modern energy efficient windows. So yes, is the answer to your question, but not just solar panels, investments in your home that are actually going to significantly reduce the energy usage of that home will also be eligible for tax breaks and tax credits.
And again, this hasn't been signed into law. That was my bad earlier in this segment. But if this were to pass, and I don't know if it's too early on to ask that question, but like, is it as simple as just proving like, hey, I had this company come in, they replaced all my windows, they are now more energy efficient. I want to now get a tax rebate on that. Is it as simple as that, or will people have to go through hoops to get money back?
Yeah, I think it's almost as simple as that. I mean, remember, we're talking about the tax code here. So, you know, there need to be safeguards. You know, you can't just say, hey, you know, I spend $100,000 on my house and not have the receipts and not, you know, not do the,
right,
the stuff you need to do to get the tax breaks, because we do care about, you know, not making it easy for people to commit fraud. But yes, at the end of the day, what it's going to involve is if for those kinds of qualifying investments, you know, you're going to save your receipts and you know, on your 1040 form, note what those expenditures were and do what you do, you know, every time you file your tax form. But again, the law doesn't even exist yet. But the idea here is that it won't be any more complicated than, doing what you do today when you say, hey, I paid, $8,000 in mortgage interest and I'd like to get a deduction for that, that it'll be a similar kind of process.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's really neat. And again, Congressman Himes is here for just about another minute before he has to go to a big decision happening this afternoon, a big vote on this bill. And then really quick, going back to Joe Manchin and the idea of what's going on with oil, I'm curious, like, does this bill address us being able to negotiate with oil companies? Because that's continued to be brought up, is the fact that, you know, one of the reasons our gas prices are so high is because, like, we're upset about it, obviously, but we only have so much to stand on, so much ground to stand on with negotiating prices for barrels of oil.
Yeah, well, Melissa, oil and gasoline trade in an open market, and the government doesn't negotiate the price. We do have an interesting conversation that we can talk about some other time about whether the government should be negotiating drug prices with the drug companies, right? Because the government, through Medicare, essentially buys a lot of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But what it does, what it actually does, is there's a number of efforts inside and outside of this bill to make it maybe negotiate is actually the right word, that would make it harder for oil companies, the Exxon Mobils of the world, et cetera, to sit on leases of public land where there's oil in the ground, to just sit on those leases, to really not pay the American people much for them, and to not produce oil. There's also some measures that will, clear up and maybe simplify the building of gasoline-producing infrastructure, by which I mean pipelines and that kind of thing. So it's going to be more along that rather than the government negotiating with, the Shells and the Exxon Mobils of the world.
And I know that the president has already said if this passes, he plans to sign it. Do you think it'll pass this afternoon?
I do. I'm not hearing, we obviously have very narrow margins in the House. And for reasons I don't understand, I don't think we're going to get any or much Republican support here. But yes, I do think it'll pass. And either way, you'll know for sure in about 3 hours.
All right. Well, Congressman Himes, I appreciate you checking in before that happens. Thank you so much. And we'll talk again soon.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. You too. That's Congressman Jim Himes here on WICC.
Birthday this morning. I'm not sure why she decided to start it off talking to me on this Friday morning, but I'm glad she's here. Jamie Stevenson, who is the Republican candidate now going up against Congressman Jim Himes in November. Congratulations, Jamie. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Thank you so much, Melissa. I'm thrilled to be here this morning. No better way to start my birthday than talking with you.
All right. Who paid you to say that? Because, I mean, like, I appreciate it, but you don't have to lie to people. It's okay. No, I'm just kidding. Thank you, Jamie. I'm glad that you're here. Honestly, I wanted to wait to see how everything went with primaries. I know you and I had talked a couple of times when you had thrown your name into the race. And once the primary election kind of wrapped up, I knew I was going to have you come on later on this week. So I'm glad that you're here. Let's just dive right into it. Okay, so you're going up against Congressman Himes. Congressman Himes is the first Democrat to have shifted this seat, what used to be a Republican seat, to Democrat. Does that intimidate you at all? You know, the stance that Congressman Himes now has, I would say, in Connecticut over his past couple of terms.
No, absolutely not. As a matter of fact, that's the motivating factor, quite frankly. If you look back in time, we had Congressman Chris Shays for a very long time. He was a moderate Republican who was able to serve all of his constituents across the district, regardless of party. And boy, have we shifted far away from that to today with our representatives who really care more about doing what their party leadership says they should do than to actually do the things that are going to help make the lives of the people in the 4th Congressional District better. That's exactly why I'm running.
So what's interesting about Chris Shays is that you're right. He was very beloved, I think, by Connecticut when he was representing the 4th District. The reason that it flipped, and of course, there's always going to be, you know, a lot of different opinions out there. But if you ask political experts, the reason it flipped is because, in their professional opinion, is because of what we were seeing politically nationally. That was around the time, wasn't that around the time that we were seeing a huge shift from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party, you know, just before entering what ended up being Obama in office for two terms. And the reason I bring that up is because right now we're in a very funky place, right? So we've got President Biden, who even we're seeing, look, this is, he's got some of the lowest ratings right now. That's not an opinion, that is a fact. But you also have the former President Donald Trump, who makes things, let's just say, very interesting. So we're in a weird place, because I think before the January 6th hearings got started, I think it was like a shoo-in, like we're going to flip back to Republican as a nation. But I feel like that's in question this morning. Do you worry about what's gone on with the former president and the outlook on Republicans sometimes locally and nationally?
I really don't. Not at all. You know, I think that's the narrative that the other team would like to keep perpetuating as we move into the midterms in 87 days. But families and businesses are concerned about other things. The inflation and the cost of living is crushing everybody right now. They're trying to figure out how to put food on the table, and now they're worried about how they're going to put fuel in their furnace this winter with gas prices, although they're beginning to come down, still so high. We have violent crime across this country like I've never seen. We have a mental health crisis. Our kids are trying to recover from the COVID pandemic. We've got a fentanyl crisis because we have open borders. And of course, we have global instability in various places across the world. These are the things that concern families each and every day. They're not looking backwards. They're looking forward. How can our federal representatives help make their lives better and help solve all of these very important issues?
They are important. And Jamie Stevenson is here this morning and is the Republican candidate going up against Congressman Jim Himes in November and looking for that District 4th seat. I would love to tackle some of those things, if you don't mind, Jamie, this morning. Let's start with mental health. Unfortunately, one of our top stories this week, a Fairfield Ward student just took their life earlier this week to suicide. This is, unfortunately, the second student just at Ward in the last year and a half, give or take, that we've seen this happen. We are seeing suicide rates just flying through the roof, not just here in Connecticut, across the country. So I know we just passed that gun legislation on a national scale, and there was a lot of money allotted for mental health. Why that was included in that bill, I think it should have been separate if you're asking me, but nobody's asking me. What more can be done when it comes to the mental health crisis? What are we lacking? What would you want to see happen?
first and foremost, it's a real commitment to the issue. And it's so sad to hear suicides, any suicide is a terrible thing for families and community. But we are seeing a rash of suicides among our young people, as you just mentioned, at Fairfield. In Fairfield, we had it here in Darien. There's crises in New Canaan. Everywhere you turn, our children are in crisis. And there just is not a commitment and making this a priority and a focus. A perfect example, Melissa, is this bill that the House is going to vote on later on today, completely misnamed, in my opinion. There is nothing in that bill that addresses the mental health crisis that we are in America. So, I think our priorities are out of whack. So I'm looking forward to getting to Congress to really help reset those priorities for the American people.
We're talking to Jamie Stevenson this morning. What about fentanyl? I know you had mentioned that fentanyl is a disaster. It is. I mean, drug trafficking is awful. We know that fentanyl is killing not just teens, but it's killing even people who try marijuana for the first time. Like, I hate to say it, but fentanyl is being laced in especially things that are being sold on the dark market, on the dark web, I should say. And it's a problem. I think fentanyl is terrifying because you've got parents who have really good kids or even young adults who are like, listen, I'm really not a drug user. But if they try, you know, a prescription drug that didn't come from their doctor, or they try Molly at a party, like things that I don't want to say are common, but they're things that do happen, especially on college campuses. And you could be talking about very good kids who just do dumb things and they try it once and that's the end of it, because fentanyl could kill you. What would you like to see better done?
Well, first of all, we have to stop the flow of fentanyl into the United States. About 90% of the fentanyl on the streets of America is coming through the southern border, from Mexico, from China, and from a few other countries. So we must make a commitment to the American people that we want to save lives by making sure that fentanyl is not finding its way onto the streets. And then we also need to work with the social media companies. You know that people can buy fentanyl-laced, quote-unquote, drugs online sometimes. I know that Snapchat has made a commitment to working to stop that practice. But, you know, social media is a part of our life. And as you said, now it's not just the terrible issue of drug addiction. It's that one pill can literally kill you, and it has. So the fact that the United States government and our representatives have avoided the issue of talking about where the fentanyl is coming from and how to stop it is a huge problem for me, and I'm really looking forward to tackling that issue.
We're chatting with Jamie Stevenson this morning. And Jamie recently run the primary here in Connecticut. She's now going up against Congressman Jim Himes in November. So we're tackling some of the big things that are important to Jamie. We were talking about mental health. We're talking about drug trafficking, unfortunately. And let's talk about, you know, the thing that is impacting every single person, no matter what they tell you, inflation. You know, if we are, I would imagine we're still going to be reeling from this when the elections are over in November. So, Jamie, if you take office, what would you propose doing to better the situation that America's in right now?
Thank you so much for asking that great question. You know, I think it really is lost on our representatives that there is no way that the federal government can spend our way out of inflation. And, you know, inflation is that wonky word, right? We're really talking about the cost of living, the increased cost to everyday families for the food they put on the table, the back-to-school supplies that families are soon going to need to buy. So we have to stop the egregious federal government spending. And I do want to say that, you know, the bill that the Senate passed already and the House is going to take up later today, I imagine it's going to pass along party lines as usual, is really misnamed. It was the Build Back Better. Now it's the Inflation Reduction Act. It is, you know, by all consulting accounts, it's not going to reduce inflation. But what it is a massive spending bill to address the Democrats' climate change agenda. At the very time that people are struggling to put food on the table, we're talking about buying solar panels. There is a complete disconnect with reality. So, you know, as I did in my job as Darien's first selectman, understood that taxpayer dollars, those are our dollars. And we need to make sure that we are good stewards of taxpayer dollars. We're using it for the right priorities, many of the things that we already talked about this morning, rather than supporting some political agenda. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm going to be a champion of families, a champion of children, and I'm very eager to get to that work after I win in November.
So for people who don't recognize Jamie Stevenson, I would be shocked because she was the first elect woman in Darien and is very well known in her community and in Fairfield County. Jamie, I'm curious, you know, so you were, I'm just trying to think with my math, you were in office when Sandy Hook happened, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, yes. So I'm curious what you think about the recently passed law that looks at guns and looks at school safety and bolstering schools with more money and with also if they want to take on red flag laws, things like that. What did you think of the newly passed law? Do you think it does enough? Do you think it's really not addressing the core problem? Like, I want to talk about school safety a little bit.
Yeah, I really appreciate that you want to talk about that. That is so important to me. Not just with Sandy Hook, but with all of the terrible tragedies that we've seen across this country. And I know that many school districts have done good things to enhance school safety. But remember, at the same time, we all agree that our children need to be safe in schools. Was the same time when there has been this tremendous pushback against law enforcement in the United States. So we need to make sure that we are partnering, that we're supporting local law enforcement, that we are giving them the tools and the training that they need to help keep our children safe. So I think the bill was really well-intentioned. I think it was great that it was one of the first and only times that I've seen Republicans and Democrats come together to try and do something. Does it do enough? I'm not sure that it does. You know, this is a state-by-state issue, literally a school-building-by-school-building issue. The local municipalities need to be given the support that they need to be able to partner with local and law enforcement. I'm a huge fan of school resource officers that are in those schools to build relationships with children to help ward off any problems that might be arising. But there are a lot of people in this country that are anti-police, especially anti-police in our schools. So we need champions of law enforcement at every level of government, and I will be that for the people of the 4th Congressional District in Congress.
Jamie, I'm curious, and I know right now this is, you know, we're down to the last couple of months, really, last few months to really hit the pavement and get people to vote. And of course, in your case, to vote in your favor. What would you say? We'll do like a little compliment sandwich, if you will. What do you think Congressman Himes has done well, but what do you think he's really done a disservice to Connecticut residents and even the country in his time in office?
I think he's learned how to be a good politician. I think he knows how to speak to the people without really being accountable for his votes and the impacts of his policy actions. I think he's well-intentioned in that he's supporting his leadership in the things that his party wants to get passed, you know, the spending and progressive policies that they want to make sure that they can push before the wave that's coming in the midterm elections. You know, I think that's what I would say about that. And now we're seeing that these policies are not working. They're simply not working domestically on the global stage. We need a reset for America. And that's going to happen in November.
Well, Jamie Stevenson, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on this morning and being able to chat with our audience about your campaign. And I do not doubt whatsoever that we won't be having you back on very, very soon. So I thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa. I look forward to it.
All right, great. And happy birthday. Yes, happy birthday.
Thank you. Thanks.
I hope you have a wonderful day with your kids. Jamie Stevenson here on WICC. So this is a pretty big news story. The CDC is relaxing some of its COVID-19 guidelines, and it's just in time for the school year, which is, well, really, it's going to get started in a matter of a couple weeks here in Connecticut. I know there are some other states that have already got, I think it's actually in Florida. This week was their first week back to school. Imagine that. But yeah, the CDC relaxing some of its guidelines. So I wanted to talk a little bit about it this morning. Dr. Andrew Wong is back on the show with Hartford HealthCare's Medical Group in Westport. Good morning, Dr. Wong. Welcome back. How are you?
Hi. Good morning, Melissa. I'm really happy to be on today and really happy to announce, exactly like you said, with the school year coming up, the CDC's made some really good guidelines, really practical guidelines so that we don't have to disrupt our routines, especially with the school kids now, with some of the newer information.
So could you talk us through some of them, you know, give us, you know, sort of the 411?
Yes, exactly. So this is really a testament to the fact that most of us have been vaccinated now. Everyone should have a first booster, by the way. If you're over the age of 50 or with some sort of underlying medical condition, you should have a second booster by now. But a lot of the information is based on the fact that we have many more treatments for people who catch COVID, that the BA4 and the BA5 variants, which are the predominant strains now, you can still catch COVID if you've been vaccinated. But we know that the probability of getting very sick from COVID now is very low. And so what the CDC has done is that they've kind of simplified the process for people who catch COVID or who have been exposed to someone with COVID. So previously, I'm sure everyone who has kids is aware of the screen to stay policy, that if you've had a vaccine, that you can still continue going to school, but if you get symptoms, you have to quarantine at home. But now it's simplified that regardless of vaccination status, you can still do a screen to stay like scenario where you have to wear a high quality mask. And by high quality mask, we mean a KN95 or an N95 mask. And as long as you're wearing that for 5 days and you have a test at 5 days and that comes out clear, you can continue to stay in school or at work, even if you've been exposed to someone with COVID.
There might be some people out there, Dr. Wong, who will say, why now? Especially because it's interesting, here in Connecticut, we're around 11% for an infection rate, and we don't know what the fall is going to bring. I think most doctors are anticipating some kind of an uptick just because that's naturally what we're probably going to see. We always see that when it gets colder out. So some may wonder, while everyone is kind of praising, oh my gosh, let's get back to some kind of normalcy, pre-pandemic ideas, some may say, is this too soon? Like, I know research is showing that some 95% of Americans either have had COVID or have the vaccine. But do you feel like it's a little too relaxed before we know how the school year is going to go?
Right. I think that the CDC is slowly accepting the fact that this may be considered endemic COVID. Endemic like a cold, endemic like a flu, that the cost of us having to disrupt our routines, if my kid stays home, I can't go to work. There's real issues with social economic issues that people can't generate income and support their families. And when we weigh that to the chances of getting critically ill, even if we were to catch COVID, what are the chances that we'd get seriously ill? It turns out that the chances are now about equivalent to a flu, for example, or about 1 in 200,000. So I think it's understanding that the kind of the balance tilts more towards being able to maintain our routines as much as possible. The BA4, the BA5 variants, the vaccines, unfortunately, don't protect us much from catching COVID. The vaccines protect us from getting very sick from COVID. And in combination with common sense guidelines, which is if we do catch COVID, staying quarantined for 5 days and returning back to society only when we no longer have a fever and only when our symptoms have gotten better do we go back in. I think it's the best compromise that we can do to keep the COVID as controlled as we can while still keeping up with our routines, which are important for our mental and physical health as well.
So, Dr. Wong, where it stands this morning, you know, what is left if any protocols are kind of in place? Like, what is sort of left for people to be doing? And also remind folks that just because things are not mandatory anymore doesn't mean that these are not practices you could or should still think about. For example, you know, like the 6 feet apart thing. You know, the way I look at that still, you know, like I'm not somebody who's just hugging random people. You know, there's nothing saying I can't. But I think if there's things that we learned during COVID, it's that sometimes we are a little bit careless when we don't need to be. So when I hear, okay, you don't have to be 6 feet apart from everybody, I think to myself, all right, so if I'm, you know, at the grocery store and I bump into someone, I don't have to panic. But it also doesn't mean, okay, let's just have close-knit conversations all the time because now there's nothing telling us not to. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Melissa. So the rules that the CDC has established are really more for daily routines, work, school, for example. And they've specifically said that they haven't made the rules yet, but they will be making those guidelines soon for congregations. So indoor parties, for example, where a bunch of people get together, weddings. Also, doctor's offices or medical offices, what are the rules for that? Are masks still required or recommended? And what type of masks should we be wearing? There's a big difference between a medical-grade N95 and 95 mask and a cloth mask. So there's still a lot of questions to be answered, I think, particularly for bigger groups all congregating together indoors. I don't think we would want people to not wear masks indoors in tight spaces in large groups. It makes sense to wear some sort of mask. Also, if I've had COVID and I've quarantined for 5 days and I feel better, should I wait a little bit longer before I see someone who's immunocompromised, or if the kids want to see their grandparents and they had COVID and were barely symptomatic? The CDC is saying rather than waiting 5 days, that it's probably a better idea to wait 10 or 11 days before coming into close contact with someone who's immunocompromised.
Well, Dr. Andrew Wong, I know, again, this is certainly, you know, I think overall whenever people hear relaxed rules or that we are pulling back things that were put into place 2 years ago because of COVID, I think on the surface, it's really great. But I'm glad you broke it down for us a little bit more. And Dr. Andrew Wong, again, is with the Hartford Healthcare Medical Group in Westport. If you want to contact him for more information, head over to this phone number. It's 877-707-4442. Dr. Wong, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Melissa. Thank you.
All right, Dr. Wong here on WICC.